This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, Kathleen Martin is back with us on Dreamland. She's been a frequent guest over the years, or fairly frequent, about every 2 or 3 years. I guess your last visit was in 2019. And Kathleen is one of the preeminent ufologists of our time. There's a little question of that. She's been researching this material since 1990, and she has worked with Stanton Friedman. They wrote a number of books together. She has been involved in MUFON's abduction research program. She has a BA in social work. Her interest in UFOs began in an interesting way. In 1961, two people had one of the all-time classic UFO experiences, and in fact, the first abduction experience that was ever widely reported, Betty and Barney Hill. Kathleen is their niece. She's the niece of Betty and Barney. And she spent 15 years analyzing their abduction and seeking to understand what has happened to them. Subsequently, she has worked on with probably at this point over 5,000 experiencers. She has 5 books published, captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, Science Was Wrong, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, The Alien Abduction Files with Denise Stoner. We interviewed them both on Dreamland. Extraterrestrial Contact, What to Do When You've Been Abducted. I interviewed Kathleen about that on Dreamland, and it's also mentioned extensively in my book, A New World, because it's an extremely important contribution to the field. She's also a contributor to the Edgar Mitchell Free Foundation, their publication Beyond UFOs, The Science of Consciousness and Contact with Non-Human Intelligence. And you can reach her at KathleenMartin.com. Have I left anything out, Kathleen? Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Whitley. I've been busy. So, yes, things have been left out, but that was long enough.
You surely have. You've been very busy, and that's great. Now, Kathleen, before we get into what you're doing right now, I'd like to go back to, and if I've just recently listened to the interviews we've done before, and we haven't really talked much about Betty and Barney and what happened there that drew your interest. Here they were, your aunt and uncle. It's the early 60s. You're younger than you are now, as we all were. What drew your interest to them, and what had happened to them?
Well, Whitley, I was 13 years old and had just arrived home from school on September 20th, 1961, and found my mother on the telephone with Betty. And she and Barney had taken a short vacation to Niagara Falls, had returned home via Canada, spent a day in Canada, and then had a close encounter on their way home. And Betty was concerned that the craft had come so close to them that they might have been contaminated. She and Barney had taken long showers when they arrived home. My mother was going to speak to a neighbor of ours who was a physicist to ask for his recommendations. Within 2 days, I was with my family at Betty's and Barney's home. I saw some of the evidence myself, and being very close family members, I saw the unfolding of everything that occurred. Betty's intense curiosity to find answers about what had happened to them, Barney's denial, Barney's emotional attempt to just forget about it. No good could come of it. He had to forget about this as fast as possible, but he couldn't forget about it. And I saw the change that took place in Barney from being the happy-go-lucky uncle who spent a lot of time with his nieces and nephews every weekend, sometimes more than once a week. And then there was the Barney who was very troubled, who developed bleeding ulcers, who had to take a three-month leave of absence from work because he was hospitalized with these bleeding ulcers and high blood pressure that would not recede with traditional medical treatment. And this was troubling to me as a youngster because I loved Betty and Barney. And I was extraordinarily curious as well. I was like Betty in that I wanted to know what had happened. What about those shiny spots on the trunk of their vehicle that hadn't been there the day before, that were in the location where they heard those buzzing sounds as they were traveling home the previous evening? What caused that? What caused the tingling sensations to pass through their bodies, their car to vibrate, for them to forget, to have a period of time, missing time, with vague memories about what had occurred during this period? So all sorts of questions. I had the opportunity to meet and observe many of the leading UFO investigators in that time frame, and was impressed by them, by their credentials, and always felt that I wanted to be like them.
You mentioned evidence, and the you touched on the shiny spots on the car. Can you describe the evidence that you were aware of right then, right literally right at first?
Yes, I was aware that their watches had stopped running, that they never ran again, in fact, that the leather strap on Barney's binoculars that he had been wearing around his neck when he walked into the field and observed these non-humans staring down at him, who he felt greatly threatened by. He felt that he was going to be captured. He pulled the binoculars away from his eyes so strenuously that he broke that leather strap. The fear that Barney exhibited, the fact that his best dress shoes were so deeply scraped that he had to purchase new shoes, that Betty's dress was torn, that there were many questions without answers.
And Betty had a very different reaction to it than Barney.
Yes.
Barney had a rough reaction, but not Betty. Betty had, tell us about Betty's reaction and her personality.
Betty was highly intelligent and a powerful woman. She was feisty, and she wanted to learn as much as she could about what had happened. She went to the Portsmouth Public Library and took out the first book that she had ever read on the topic. There was an address inside the book for the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. So a few days later, she sat down with Barney and wrote a letter to NICAP. And that brought Walter Webb, astronomer and investigator, to their home. She talked to people in the Air Force about this. The upstairs neighbors, her tenants, were in the man was in the Air Force, stationed at Pease Air Force Base. She wanted to know more. What had Pease seen that craft? And yes, it was recorded on radar, or a craft was recorded on radar by Pease Air Force Base at 2:14 a.m., at about the time that we later found out they were released. That could explain what happened to them. Betty had memories of finding themselves on a dirt road with tall trees all around, of encountering a roadblock, of observing a fiery orb that seemed to be sitting on the ground, trying to dismiss it as the setting moon, but knowing that it couldn't possibly have been that. And in the fall of 1961, the late fall, and then into the spring, she and Barney would make trips, weekend trips to the White Mountains to try to find that road that they found themselves on, where they encountered that roadblock. So Betty had no conscious recall of observing these entities. Barney did. I mean, Betty only remembered a roadblock. She didn't remember what they looked like. Barney had conscious recall of observing the entities when he was standing in that field, looking up at that craft that was hovering only 100 feet overhead, of seeing little lights slide out from two parts of the craft and something start to drop down out of the bottom of the craft that frightened him so badly. Betty was curious. She would talk to anyone. She talked to UFO investigators. She talked to military people. She talked to scientists, anyone who might have some information that could help her to understand what had occurred that night.
Now, Barney, can you tell us what Barney saw when he looked up at the craft and saw the entities looking down at him? What did he see?
Well, I have the original records, and what he saw were figures dressed in black, shiny uniforms looking down at him. And then suddenly, all but one turned and walked to what appeared to be a panel. When this occurred, he could now see them from the tops of their heads to their knees. And their arms went up. And when this occurred, little red lights started to slide out from the craft on fin-like structures. And this is when something started to drop down as well. He was looking at the one who remained at the window and was greatly frightened by him. Barney thought that he was about to be captured like a bug in a net. And that's a quote. He, in his earliest report to Walter Webb, stated that these entities were somehow not human. They were of a superior type.
I wonder why he said superior.
They were absolutely technologically superior.
Yes.
You know, so I don't know. I can't read Barney's mind. That's a good question.
Yeah. Because he seemed to sense, Barney seemed to have more of a sense of the sort of the gestalt or the feeling of the situation than Betty did.
Yes.
Betty first had no memories, no direct memories, so she wasn't aware of the sense that Barney had that they were about to be captured.
Correct.
Like a bug. I mean, it's a... Do you suppose Barney had some previous awareness of this? Buried in him somewhere?
There's a possibility. He and Betty were hypnotized separately by Dr. Benjamin Simon beginning in January of 1964. And the questions actually started in February of that month. But he took Betty and Barney separately, and he reinstated amnesia at the end of each session. And he was talking to Barney. It was more like hypnoanalysis for Barney, because Dr. Simon was a psychoanalyst. And he would always ask Barney to compare his emotional state to some time in the past. And was Barney was looking up at this craft as it was hovering overhead. It reminded him of a time when he was a child in a field on the farm in Virginia. And he talked about a little bunny, and the bunny thought that he was protected, but that Barney was able to take his hat and put it down and catch that little bunny. And Barney said to Dr. Simon, "I'm that bunny." So had Barney previously had contact? I don't know. There's a possibility of it, but I do believe that Betty probably did.
So why do you believe that of Betty? Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Free Dreamlanders, I've got to admit, it's time for you to look at some commercials or listen to them. We'll be right back. We're talking to Kathleen Marden, her website, kathleen-marden.com. You can find all of her books there, and some of them are also available on the unknowncountry.com store. But if you want an autographed copy of her books, the place to go is kathleenmarden.com. You can also find out there what she's up to, which is always a lot. Tell us, Kathleen, before we go on, where you're going to be speaking next.
I have a conference coming up in Italy, but it's going to be a virtual conference like most of the conferences this year.
Yes. Yeah, I've missed all of the non-virtual conferences for one reason or another. I know you made it to Roswell.
Yes, and to Michigan, too.
Yeah, and I missed both of them. I all I can say is this, folks, if you want to go somewhere and you have a specific schedule and something to do, I would avoid American Airlines and Southwest Airlines because they do not work properly anymore. Now let's get back to Betty. And you thought that Betty may have had abduction experiences before.
Yes. I do believe that there's a possibility that this occurred. The reason I believe that is because she didn't have the level of fear that Barney had initially. Yet when she realized under hypnosis that they were the entities that Barney had seen when he was in the field looking up at them, he told her that, she became terrified. She tried to escape and run away from them, but she failed. When she was being taken to craft, she then again fought for her life and tore her dress in the process before they took control of her. But she lost her fear. She spoke to the one that she called the leader, that I think of as the escort who makes experiencers feel comfortable and in a familiar environment. She said to him, "No, you're not from around here. Where's your home port?" And he showed her a star map that became very important evidence in her case. When Dr. Simon asked her to draw it from memory, if she could remember it accurately, and it didn't trouble her too much. So that was just another piece of evidence. But as she was leaving the craft, after she had fought for that, what she called a book that was sort of like a tablet with alien script or symbols embedded in it, she was being escorted out. They wouldn't give her the book. She was being escorted out, and she was talking to the leader, and he seemed apologetic. This is telepathic communication. Apologetic for frightening her so badly, even though they did tell Betty and Barney they wouldn't be harmed. They only had to do a few simple tests. And Betty finally said to him, "Well, do you think you could come back? If you can come back again, then I can find people who know a lot more about this than I do. I'm just a common person, she said. And he said to her, it's not my decision to make. Maybe I can come back. And Betty said to him, well, how would you find me? Out of all of the people on this planet, how would you find me? And he said, we can always find those we're looking for. It made me think that they were probably looking for Betty that night.
Do you think that this is something that has been running in your family?
I do think that, and the reason that I think that is Dr. James Harder came to my family in the 1970s, and he hypnotized several members of my family. My mother had had a close encounter with a craft way back in 1957 when she was making her weekly grocery shopping trip. Another aunt was with her, and there was a very large, what we think of as a mothership, cigar-shaped, hovering over a field, and there were smaller craft flying into it or out of it, around it. She stopped the car at a nearby house. She knew the people who lived there, and they saw this craft as well. So it became a multiple witness sighting. Then there was another time that I remember. I was a little older in my teenage years, and she was grocery shopping on a Friday night again. And this time she simply did not arrive home at the appointed time. She was very consistent in the time that she would arrive home. And we were distressed over this, what had happened to my mother. My father was talking about calling the police. And finally, my mother arrived. And when she didn't realize that she was late. The frozen food had thawed, the ice cream was soup, and there was no explanation for what had occurred. So Jim Harder was interested in this. In addition to this, in 1966, Betty was working with a team of scientists. They would give her a script that she was to read and attempt to contact through telepathic communication these extraterrestrials. And she was outside doing this night after night. And one of the things that she was supposed to tell them was that they should land on my grandparents' farm in Kingston, New Hampshire. I grew up across the street from my grandparents' farm. One did come in and land. It was observed by my grandmother and by a commercial pilot who was returning home from work. And I had memories of finding myself on a craft. I didn't talk about it at first. It was a trust issue with my mother because she was there. And I thought that she had coordinated some kind of secret surgery on me and had brought a medical team in, which doesn't make sense at all to me as an adult.
Right.
But that was the only explanation I had at that time, but I couldn't remember the faces on those doctors who were standing around me. And finally, I had an abreaction, a huge release of emotion, and I recalled what they looked like. And they were the type of grays that abducted my aunt and uncle. And then periodically, I had contact.
And now here you are.
Yes, here I am.
All of these years later, just like the rest of us who are vocal about this, not many of us who are out in public have had just a single experience, unless it was a very extraordinary and intensely memorable one, like the one that happened, say, to Mark Sims, who had his, I don't know if you know Mark's story, but my listeners do. He's been on the show and he's become a good friend, but he had a single overwhelmingly powerful experience of meeting an entity that he believes is called Tejbar. And it turned out it's just an extraordinary story, folks. So if you're a subscriber, go and listen to the Mark Sims show. You'll find it fascinating. In any case, that's a rarity. Mm-hmm. Most of us have had lifelong contact and still do. I mean, I'm still involved with them. I'm not being abducted anymore, I don't think. But my last missing time experience was a couple of months ago. When speaking of Mark Sims, he and Danny Sheehan were coming over and we were going to spend the afternoon together and have dinner. And I proceeded to have a missing time experience, which was easily identified. There's no question at all. It was a 23-minute to 22-minute missing time experience right before they came. Mm-hmm. And what in the world was it about? And so is the experience still active in your life at this point?
It is active, but it has changed. Back in 2016, I began a series of experiments with a man who had been communicating with a group of extraterrestrials dating back to when he was an 8-year-old boy. And this was just a sort of an observational experiment. We didn't know if he was delusional, if he was a hoaxer, what was going on. And we met once a month for 2 years. And each of us in the group of researchers were invited to ask questions, which we did, and we received answers. We met the Council of Eight, the individuals in the council, through Kevin, who is a medium, who sort of channeled the information. There were two ninth dimensionals, and those ninth dimensionals had an incredible amount of energy, just filling up the room with this very strong tingling sensation in our bodies. They increase the temperature in that portion of the room by about 7 degrees when they were there. There were also other members of the Council of Eight that we were introduced to. For the most part, we couldn't see them. We did see what appeared to be feathers on one, but there were different varieties of ETs. There were tall human types. There was an average gray and a tall gray. There was an avian. There was a tall white. And there was an insectoid.
And they were, you know, I don't have any sense personally of any organization or any large groups like that. I know Kevin also. He's been on the show. I believe you're speaking of Kevin.
Yes.
Yes. Right. He's been on this show as well. And he was present. He was actually driving the car around in the Black Hills and on the Lakota Sioux Reservation in the summer of 2019 when I had the experience of seeing into another world, apparently a parallel universe. And I'm going to bring that up in a little while because there's a fascinating story in your latest book about it that I mention in A New World, and I want to talk about it a little further later. In any case, I have no sense of these organizations at all. It's a very personal experience for me, my contact experience. I use my implant to do research on my books, And at 3 o'clock in the morning, I usually have an exchange about what I'm working on with somebody. I don't even know who it is. I sometimes think it's my wife, but I'm never sure.
Yes.
I've never been sure.
Well, I've never been sure that they were extraterrestrials. I've never been sure that they were extraterrestrials. But I do know that the extraterrestrials that I had contact with during my lifetime are no longer taking me. And they haven't taken me since this group said that they would protect me. And I look at them.
You're saying that being taken is something hostile or something we don't want.
Well, I was terrified for years and years and could not resolve that terror. I finally developed a technique that I use to overcome that feeling of fear, that fight or flight response, by instantly hypnotizing myself when they came into my environment and projecting love toward them. That changed everything.
That's interesting, because my book, Jesus, A New Vision, which is about embracing the good, changed everything for me very profoundly. Mm-hmm. I don't have that awful sense of doom, I would say, that of being something awful being done to me that I used to live with, and I lived with for a long time. But some of the scars that remain from my early experiences will never leave me. Mm-hmm. And I had semen taken from my body, and that is, I'll never forget it. And I'll never stop wondering what happened to that part of me, because that was part of me given to me by God, and it was taken.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot rape a man more profoundly than that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it. And I know many women have had similar and awful things happen to them with regard to their eggs. And I've seen babies. They've seen babies. What is your reaction to this? How do you understand this aspect of it?
The way I've come to understand it is that these grays are what I think of as the collectors. When we began to explode nuclear weapons, they tore into the fabric of time and space and across dimensions and caused harm in other dimensions, and these entities came through. They were seen. Their craft was seen every time there was the detonation of a nuclear weapon. In fact, the early scientists wondered if they were somehow some kind of fallout as a result of what had occurred. And so they are very concerned that our technological progress is out of balance with our spiritual growth. And when this occurs, there can be a massive loss of life, a huge holocaust that destroys life on the planet. And they say that they planted our seed here, that they have come back from time to time to assist in our development. And this time they are alarmed. They haven't left. They have been collecting DNA of flora and fauna and even humans for many, many years in case it happens. But Kevin's counsel said that we have destroyed ourselves before, and they won't let us do it this time. They will intervene. They will shoot down our missiles if they can. They're also very concerned about a population that have not been good stewards to the environment, who have exploited the planet to our own detriment. And they I believe, are attempting to upgrade the human genome to produce a more survivable, more resilient, and more highly spiritually involved human.
Spiritually competent, I would
yes.
say.
Yeah.
Well, Free Dreamlanders, speaking of competence, it's time for you to take a little break, enjoy these commercials, and we'll be right back with Kathleen Marden. We're talking to Kathleen Marden. Her website, Kathleen-Marden, M-A-R-D-E-N.com. You can find her many books there, and if you want an autographed copy, that's where to get it. Kathleen, can people get directly in touch with you?
They can. They can go to my website at Kathleen-Marden.com, and all of my books are available to be purchased through PayPal, and I will autograph all of them.
Great. Well, that would be worth doing, folks. And so, because Kathleen is a truly extraordinary and unique individual in this field, as you can see, she came to it. She was really brought to it, in a sense, by the visitors themselves, and ended up in this extraordinary situation of having not only a lifetime of experience with them and the niece of the man and woman who had one of the most famous experiences of all time, and she is highly knowledgeable and skilled and capable as a researcher. And isn't it extraordinary, Kathleen, how strange the conclusions you draw are in terms of this research, because it's obvious that something is being done that involves our bodies.
Yes.
And I've thought that maybe they might be making a kind of genetic record of us on the theory that we might go extinct. Could that be a possibility, because not only is our nuclear weapons and nuclear catastrophes definitely of interest to them, so is environmental stuff. I've gotten a lot of that. I've written two books as a result of that, in fact, Nature's End and Superstorm, as a result of their warnings. So I have to wonder, is this a hostile presence, or are they trying to preserve something? I just can't quite get my head around where they are. And I thought that you might have a better idea of that.
In terms of their presence, I know that a small group is hostile, but for the most part, these non-humans are not hostile. They're collectors, they're caretakers of the planet, in a sense. On the studies that I participated in as a researcher, the first being the Edgar Mitchell Free Foundation's experience or study, 83%, I believe it was, stated that they would not end their contact experiences if they had the opportunity to do so. We asked the same question of the 516 people who participated in our MUFON experience or research team study. And 71% of the experiencers, 75% of the abductee group said that they would not end their experiences. So there's something that draws them to these non-humans, a sense that they want to learn more. I can tell you from my own personal experience, they projected a feeling of love toward me that was greater than any love I have ever experienced on this planet. And they telepathically told me that we are family, that there is no reason to be fearful. They told me that they had to extract these tissues from my body because they were checking me for toxicity. And as I think about that, Whitley, I grew up just downhill from a waste dump, a chemical waste dump that polluted the rivers, the streams, the wells, and the lake. It became a Superfund site. And only 20 miles from my childhood home and where Betty and Barney lived were a nuclear Air Force base and a nuclear submarine base. So,
how interesting. That's absolute. I did not know that before. And yet I happen to know that there are numerous people in the nuclear submarine fleet who have had very extensive encounters. In fact, we had a show on Dreamland with two of them, a man and woman who preferred to remain anonymous, who were had an encounter that lasted days, and he was a communications officer on a nuclear submarine. And so that group of people is a kind of a special group. A lot of military people are involved in this in different ways. Mm-hmm. And not only that, when pilots are ordered to make aggressive maneuvers toward these things, these objects, as soon as likely as not, the visitors show up a little while later in their children's bedrooms. Yeah. So, hey, there's a definite correlation there.
There is. And I found that in my work as well, Whitley. The children and the enlisted people on nuclear bases, and also the children of nuclear engineers, scientists working on nuclear programs for the U.S. government.
Yes, that too. And special forces officers and a lot of different military people are involved. Now, this gets me to a very large question that I've been wanting to ask more often of different experts who have come on the show. This seems to me to be very much farther advanced in the United States than it is anywhere else in the world. I mean, the whole meshing of contact that's going on. Am I wrong about that? And if I'm not, if you feel it's the case, can you discuss why you think it may be the case?
Well, Whitley, I think that in the United States, we have physicists who are working on this, such as Rudy Shield and Claude Swanson, who have moved us ahead in our understanding that this is beyond the nuts and bolts, that it is much more, that it involves consciousness. And we have been open with our studies of consciousness. So I think that we have a population in the United States that has greater knowledge of all of this. And some of the investigators are open to this. The investigators on MUFON's experience or resource team, that's what it's called now, and are far more open-minded. They realize that there are orbs, that intelligent orbs in people's homes involved in all of this, yes. That there is communication with what appears to be maybe a non-human to a human. The human's visual range cannot see that individual, but they can certainly feel the tingling sensation and receive the telepathic messages. When I have written or done programs in Europe, I found that the investigators are years behind us in their investigations. They're still in the nuts and bolts. They're still wondering if alien abduction is even real, if what the evidence is for it. So I guess that Italy is more open-minded, but certainly other parts of Europe are not. In Australia, I'm finding that people are more open-minded as well.
Yes. Australia is another country that has had a lot of this.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's second only to the United States in that respect. Mm-hmm. And they've got a big installation there at Pine Gap, which has a lot to do with this stuff, I'm pretty sure. Mm-hmm. Now, when we look at this and we look at the research that's been done, there are researchers who are very sure that this is something really, really evil and really dangerous. And they have, I don't know if it's a self-selected sample or not. I'm on the fence because I've had all of the worst experiences that Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs talk about happened to me and my wife, every single one of them. And they were not easy. They're terrible experiences. They're right about that. But it's not so much happening anymore. The abductions, I think, are they over, would you say? I think Ray Hernandez of Free thinks they pretty much are.
The ERT from MUFON has discussed that. They think that the breeding program is probably over, and not as many people are being taken to craft. I've spoken to individuals who now will just see a portion of their home open up and these entities just step into the human environment.
I've seen that myself. Uh-huh. I woke up one night at my country place and the roof was gone. We had a cathedral ceiling in the bedroom and there was nothing there. But the thing that was so remarkable is above it, you did not see stars. You saw just darkness, and it was awesome, whatever that darkness was. And then I could see these entities peering down at me around the edges of this open roof. And the next thing I knew, I ended up having something like a life review that must be like what happens after you're dead, I guess. And those are dramatic experiences, and a lot of us have them. You've had them too, I'm sure.
I have. And I've been wondering what this is all about. Why am I having these life reviews over again?
Me too. And, you know, when we're coming to the end of the free part of Dreamland, and when we go on, we're going to be talking more about these experiences and more also, I want to get back to the star map, and I want to discuss possible ways of moving between the stars, because after all, even if you're moving at 99% of the speed of light, you're crawling because the distances between the stars are so enormous. But we want to get into that. So, Free Dreamlanders, I would like to thank you for being with us as always. And each week, some of you, three or four of you, usually not many more than that, will subscribe to the show. I would hope that this week it's more. And if you've been thinking about doing it. You can listen to the previous Kathleen Marden shows. You can listen to our wonderful show with Kevin Briggs. There is so much on Dreamland, on Unknown Country, that you can value. Now, to get more deeply into Kathleen and her work, which I advise strongly, go to Kathleen Marden. That's Kathleen-Marden, MARDEN.com, and take it from there. Her books are truly remarkable works. I think I've actually read them all. And we have touched on some of the things. Extraterrestrial Contact is the last one we interviewed Kathleen about on this show in 2019, a remarkable book. prior to that, we talked with her about Captured. We talked to her with her about Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. We had a long interview with her and Denise Stoker about the Alien Abduction Files. There is so much here. Thank you so much for staying with, being with us on Dreamland, and subscribers. We're just going to keep right on keeping on. Kathleen, I wonder very much where this is going. In other words, we're coming to a point of no return, I think, in the environment very quickly, probably more quickly than we realize. When I wrote A New World, the last words of it are, it is time. It's time for them to come forward. But they don't. They don't. Is it that they can't? Is there some kind of conflict among them, perhaps, that prevents them from the ones who want to help us from doing so? What is going on, do you think?
What the Council of Eight told me when I asked that question is that they have gone to our heads of state, they have gone to our business leaders, and they are not interested in changing anything. They are not interested in a reveal. And so then they went to the general population and started from the bottom up and believe that at some point we'll reach a tipping point where most of us realize that we are being visited. Now, they also expressed concern that if they were to reveal themselves over the major cities around the world, that it could be interpreted as an invasion. And that
it would be by some people.
Oh, absolutely. It would be by our military, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
And then there could be dire consequences as a result of this, because we would feel that we had to fight against them, to use our weapons on them, and they don't want that to happen.
Right. And I think that we've done, well, back in 1947 or 48, there was a story in one of the Washington papers, I believe, I forget which one, to the effect that there had been an order to shoot them down. And then there was a follow-up story from an astronomer saying, let's not do that. Let's not be hostile. But I think we've had a long history of hostility toward them.
We have had a long history. Even though the official reports say they do not present a danger to us, we certainly are now perceiving them as a danger at a federal level. And with talk about programs to defend ourselves against them. So, this is the way we perceive anything from outside this earth, and anything that is not trading with us, and some of the countries that are trading with us are seen as a threat. So, there's the control issue, the threat issue, the monetary productivity issue, especially for those who hold the power. So there are many things that I believe are influencing our attitude. But yes, back in the early days, during the times when the Air Force was conducting study after study after study on this, they were told to shoot them down. And many of our planes were shot down. And they decided that they would change their policy, the U.S. policy.
Right. I don't think they're in a shooting war anymore, but they may be. It's hard to know exactly, but I know that, it had a strange family connection because the commandant of the airbase where the Mantell incident occurred ended up living with his family around the corner from us. Yeah. Guy Hicks, Colonel Hicks, and I knew his children, and my daddy would gently question me about what we had done, talked about when I came back from playing with them. So there was some kind of connection. My uncle was involved in the Roswell incident at Wright Field. And these family connections, I think, are very important to this. I think that they go down family lines, and maybe they've been doing that for a very much longer time than we realize.
Well, what they told me, Whitley, is that initially they had opportunistic abductions. They took a lot of children playing on the backlands of the family farms, that sort of thing, people just driving down the highway, people fishing, hiking, camping. And then when they found the DNA that they thought they wanted or that could survive an environmental collapse, they started taking people along family lines.
That's fascinating. And maybe that's an explanation. Do you think they want us to survive, or will they wait until the catastrophe happens and then kind of pick up the pieces?
I think that they want us to survive, but if we detonate nuclear weapons, if we're involved in a nuclear war in Korea, how quickly could they come to our aid? And and I'm thinking about the people who live in these countries, not the leaders and the controllers who would want this war to take place, but the innocent victims. I hope that they would come to our aid. They said that they would attempt to.
Attempt to is the word.
Yes.
And I feel like the environmental situation is so dire and changing so quickly. And I've asked them many times, if you would just show up, this whole community of witnesses who have been interacting with you for so long and all have this message, can bring the message forth. This is what they want. And they are here and they are real. But they don't do that. They don't cross over that line. There's a woman called Anjali Schultz. Are you familiar with her at all?
I'm familiar with that first name.
Anjali. Well, she's claiming she has a long CV in the intelligence community. None of it is relevant to this. Mm-hmm. But she's claiming that she encountered ETs in a cave in the Mojave Desert, and that she's going to take a group of people there to videotape them before the end of 2021. Mm-hmm. And I'm being told from time to time, someone will say, well, she's asking people on Reddit who she should ask to go. And I'm wondering, at first she said, well, she had a list from them of who she wanted. And I'm remembering now Kevin Briggs's belief that there would be something happening in 2020 and that he should tell the UN about it, and it didn't happen.
Right.
And I've got a funny feeling this won't happen either.
Well, they were seeking permission from the UN in 2020, and the UN did not follow through on that through the letters that Kevin wrote. He then went to New York City thinking that there would be a reveal. It was overcast. It was raining, but they did not show up. And I found that this has happened repeatedly. Historically, dating back to 1954 and 1956 with Admiral Herbert Knowles, who was a rear admiral, and Wilbert Smith, and a woman named Frances Swan. I acquired these records from Admiral Knowles' granddaughter, my Aunt Betty and Barney and Uncle Barney were invited to Admiral Knowles' house. He, after he retired, he was on the board of directors of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And he and Wilbert Smith were conducting a scientific study on the statements that these ETs were giving to Frances Swan. Frances Swan took a thick packet of information to Admiral Knowles' house. And after he read it, he believed that it was of vital national security. And so it contained science far beyond the level of education or understanding of Frances Swan, this woman who lived in Elliott, Maine. And so he passed that packet to Margaret Chase Smith, senator from Maine, and it went to Dwight Eisenhower. And I wrote about this in Free's book, Beyond UFOs, the first book that was published by Free. I had a chapter in that. I'm writing a more detailed chapter right now based upon the information. I had that information sitting in my locked files for 10 years before I began to speak of it. What Admiral Knowles and Wilbert Smith were able to determine is that the messages that Frances Swan was receiving were internally consistent, that she had more hits than misses, and that there was this same concern that you and I have discussed today. But when these ETs were going to show their craft to the CIA, they didn't show up the first time. When Mrs. Swan was going to do a demonstration in front of members of the military, they wouldn't show up on time. And it was always, oh, well, we were busy. And finally, they did show their craft to the five officers from the CIA. And, you know, so that time it worked. But I found that this happens with the Council of Eight as well. And it makes me wonder, who are the Council of Eight? I asked them specifically, are you extraterrestrials? Or are you interdimensionals? Or are you deceased humans who are having fun with us? And yeah. The answer was always a little bit troublesome, because they would say extraterrestrials to you, but not to ourselves.
Well, that would be true, of course. I mean, we'd be extraterrestrials to someone from another planet.
Oh, of course. Yes. It was that response time and time again. They said that they are souls, just like us, that we are all part of one consciousness, and that there is the source consciousness, which is the highest consciousness.
Well, something along those lines must be true. I think it almost has to be. And, you know, I want to shift gears now, because I want to go back to what is, for me, remains the most extraordinary experience of my life, even more so than the first close encounter, the experience of seeing into the other universe, the parallel universe that happened on the Lakota Sioux Reservation on Pine Ridge. And then the subsequent events, which included two physical movements into that universe here in Santa Monica. And unfortunately, because of my efforts to do this, I left with a damaged right eye. and I can't do it anymore. But the where I'm going is this: you have a story in Extraterrestrial Contact, mm-hmm. about a man who had a little airport, and he and his mother. Can you tell us a little bit about that story? And then we've heard it before on Dreamland. So I want to particularly focus in on what he and his mother saw, because I think it's quite important here.
Yes. His family was very concerned about his mental health, believing that these entities were visiting the airport and taking him. So he said to his mother, please give me a chance. Just stay with me, and I'll show you that this is real. And that day, he and his mother were looking out the window, and what they saw was no longer the runway and the lights on the runway, but mammoths grazing on a grassy savanna.
Which, my impression of that world is really very strongly that it exists not in the past, but in this time, but it has not had, its ice age hasn't ended. And I have a lot of reasons that I could go into to say that. First of all, it's much darker, and there's more cloud cover. And here in Santa Monica, where I used to be able to see it, which is where I lost my eye, I was trying too hard, concentrating with too much attention, and it caused the optic nerve to swell, and I lost part of the vision. I could see that the shoreline went out miles farther than it does now. And during the Ice Age, the last Ice Age and previous Ice Ages, it did just that, because all of the water was locked up in the ice in the glaciers. And so I have to wonder, are they from there? Because they did not like me going in there. They did not want me there. And the first time I went into it physically, I'm not sure whether I exchanged souls with someone else, even another version of me or not. But the fact that he saw those mammoths and his mother, it just makes me ask you a question, and I'm not sure you can even get to the answer, but I think you might have something fascinating to say if you try. Where are we? And if this world ends, what happens to that one? There's a huge burning questions in my mind, Kathleen.
They are burning questions for me as well. I've talked to people who have been walking on a beach, a husband and wife, and suddenly they were back in World War II. Everything about them was from the 1940s. This has happened to other people as well, that almost like, I don't know if it's an interdimensional portal or a time slip, whatever you want to call it. What is going on this planet? Why is this occurring? Did it occur in the past? Or is this the result of detonation of nuclear weapons? Or...
Yeah, that's a good question. Are nuclear weapons deranging something more profoundly than we know?
Yes.
Because the visitors are certainly very concerned about nuclear weapons, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Where do you think this will go? Because what I think is going to happen here over the next 10 years is the planet is going to become very much unlivable on a lot of different levels and in a lot of different places. I think we could be facing mass famine very easily, because the three great growing areas of the world, which are the Russian-Ukrainian steppe, Argentina, and Brazil and the United States and Canada, those are the main ones, are vulnerable to climate change. The crops are vulnerable to overheating, and they're vulnerable to drought. And both of those things could happen. And if they happen in all of these places at the same time or over the same year, we're going to have mass famine on planet
Earth. We will.
I worry about that every day of my life. My kids, our children, all of us, our grandchildren, what will happen to them?
It is my understanding, Whitley, that we are standing on the precipice, ready to go over the edge, but I don't know what that means. It's just, I belong to a meditation group, and as a result of this, just overnight from messages we received, we began the Awakening Souls support group for people who are awakening to what is next, what all of this means. But none of us know at this point.
Tell us more about the Awakening Souls support group, because I have a feeling there are a number of people listening to this who might want to get involved in that.
Well, if anyone wants to get involved, you can go to the website. It's called The Awakening Souls, the-awakening-souls.com. And you can fill out an application. But before you do, please read what we have written, because we are looking for people who are appropriate for the group. We have many individuals who have been lifelong experiencers. Some of these people are well known across the United States. Some are not. Some are new and just coming in. But the one thing that they all have in common is the strong sense that they need to help others, to assist others in understanding. And at the same time, we're all assisting one another in attempting to understand what all of this means and what the next step is.
Because there has to be a next step. I mean, I all of us with children and grandchildren demand it. We need a next step. And what is so is there an can you imagine a situation where the visitors would come out physically and in 5 minutes change our world? Can you imagine any conditions under which that would happen? Or do you know if they've ever given anyone anything about that that has not yet, well, and Jolly Schultz supposedly. But, you know, I just have so little faith in these things because it's been going on for so long. I'm rambling here a little bit, and folks, please excuse me, but the emotions here are tremendously powerful. I want us to survive, Kathleen.
I do as well. And, you know, I don't know. You look at Christopher Bledsoe, and he views all of this as angelic, in a sense, that it's all positive. I investigated an abduction on his property. There were two experiencers, two women who had their own paranormal research team and wanted to conduct research on the property of a known experiencer, a confirmed experiencer. So I contacted Chris and told him about this, and he said, sure, they could come to his home. So they set up their equipment. One was a historian, the other has a master's degree in archaeology, a bachelor's degree in religion and anthropology, worked her entire career taking care of all of the theses in a medical research facility at the university. major university, and is now retired. But they had everything set up. They're outside. They have a video camera, Bell and Howell video camera, set up in another part of the yard. It's running. And they are down looking for Kraft to come in. Chris is attempting to call in Kraft. There's one that appears next to the moon, and it's growing in size. He says, well, I think that's them. And Pamela is asking questions. She has an EVP and a device and a recorder attempting to capture electronic voice phenomena. And the next thing they know, they're no longer holding the equipment that was in their hands. They are standing. They are reeling back and forth, feeling nauseated. They pick up everything. They finally find the equipment under a bush and take down the video camera, go back into the house. And Chris's wife says, where have you been? And I said, oh, we've just been outside. And she says, do you realize what time it is? It's 1 o'clock in the morning now. She said, I've been looking for you when you weren't out there. Well, I did an investigation. I hypnotized both of the women a year apart. And when I use hypnosis, I don't offer a lot of suggestions. I try to get a true regression. And they remembered what had occurred. And what is most remarkable is on that video camera, they captured a few seconds of these non-humans entering our environment. There was a beam, kind of a light indigo colored beam. And in one of those slides on that film, I did a frame by frame analysis. In one of those frames, I could see what appeared to be a partially materialized entity dropping off the beam. And as she came closer to the ground, she became more fully materialized and larger, I think. There was another entity sitting on the ground, legs crossed, hands on the ground, appeared to have something on his back. All of a sudden, he rose up into the air. It became obvious that he was sitting on something. His feet were resting on some kind of chair-type platform, and he appeared to have a backpack on his back. And he had a blue light in one hand and a white light in the other. And as he was gliding along in front of the camera, not aware that he was being recorded, he was turning his body back and forth, just looking. And then it captured what appears to be a mantis-type entity sitting in a tree with a very triangular greenish face and hands that are kind of like, let me see if I can show you, like this, but without all the fingers, more like mitten-type hands, large hands. And then there's a huge flash of light, and there's another entity up near the camera. It's wearing black clothing. It appears to have accordion pleats on the arms. It's wearing some kind of headgear. You can see kind of a chiseled nose and what might be parts of eyes that have kind of a human appearance. And I didn't mention that the entity that was flying had what appeared to be a metallic band across its forehead with maybe an antenna. I'm not sure what it was, but it jutted up and then back over the head. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. We have one of the communion letters that mentions an antenna like that, seeing it. Now, is this video available or?
It's only available now when I speak at conferences on that topic. I've only spoken one time so far and showed that video. The women have copyrighted the video and have given me permission to show parts of it. But we are hoping that at some time in the future, there will be a legitimate enterprise who's not going to sensationalize this, but will show this film to the American people.
Because there are, I know quite a few very reputable documentary people who might be quite interested in it and might be willing to show it to the American people. Is it clear?
They weren't posing for the pictures. Some of it is taken far away. What I had to do is to lighten it because it was taken in the dark, and then I had to enlarge it as large as I could so that I would actually be able to view it, and it wouldn't just become a blur.
Yeah, I see. So it's not what the general media would like. It's not that clear.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe so. I don't know what kind of equipment they have that would enhance it so that it would become very clear. I have on my cell phone one of the photographs that I've enlarged, and I'm willing to show that if.
Oh, could you send me a copy of it and we can show it on this show?
Yes, or I could hold it up to the camera now.
No, don't hold it up. We'll show it on the, we'll show it very clearly. You don't need to hold it up.
Okay.
So we will show that, folks. Good. And you can see that. I'm glad that there's something that we can see because, and for those of you who are listening on podcast apps or on the website and not looking at the video, the image will be on the Dreamland show page, so you'll be able to see it too. So, Kathleen, where do you go from here? You've alluded to some things you're working on, a new book, for example. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
It is a book about my life and the people I encountered who were my mentors and my moving forward toward understanding from being that child who lived in terror to the person that I am today, who is no longer fearful, and what I've learned along the way. I'm involved in consciousness studies now, in doing a lot of meditation and in work with this Awakening Souls group.
I think the Awakening Souls group is very important, and I'm going to be sure that it's linked on the show page. I think that a lot of people on unknowncountry.com who come to the site come to it because they are engaging with this, beginning to engage with it more on a spiritual level. And I think that's the direction, that the fact that we're not engaged with it in this way in general is why they don't show up. Because there's too much of a gap. Unless you begin to engage on this level, then the gap narrows. Mm-hmm. And so it's really up to all of us folks, hear this, see this. We have to do this. And I think the only direction that's going to help is this direction, because I think that's where they're coming from. And I have we're coming close to the end of our time together. Can you tell me about your impression of the relationship between our own dead and this whole phenomenon?
It's perplexing to me. I know that many people, including you, have seen your deceased relatives on craft and appearing in your home as well to you. There seems to be some kind of, I don't know what it is, portal to me, whatever, I'm not sure. But I have communicated with my deceased relatives, with Betty, with Barney, with my father, with my mother. And also Stanton Friedman and I had an agreement that whoever died first, we would attempt to visit the other. And he did come to visit me.
Oh, can you tell us about that? I miss Stanton so much. He was such a wonderful man. You two were so close and did such fabulous work together. But tell us about that.
Thank you. Well, on the morning that Stanton died, I wasn't aware that he was deceased. But he came to me. There was another man with him. And he sort of spoke in this kind of hypnopompic dream. And then I woke up. He was going to call me. He had been speaking to a group out in Columbus, Ohio. And when he arrived home, there were some things he wanted to talk to me about. Then later that day, I learned that he was deceased, that he died in an airport in Toronto when he was returning home. And that night, I went to bed. I was wide awake. My husband was preparing for bed. We had the light on in the bathroom, but I was in the bedroom, which is attached to the bathroom. And I felt strong tingling through my body first, complete body tingling, kind of this electrical sensation. And then I heard the words, "I'm sorry, Kathy."
And Stanton all the way. He dies and apologizes.
Yes, he did. All the time.
That was a real experience, Kathy, for sure.
And I opened my eyes, and there is this bright little orb up in the corner. It had a very bright center. And I said, "Is that you?" And he said, he indicated to me that it was. And I just said, "Come give me a hug." And I didn't see the orb come toward me, but I felt sort of his essence. And I could detect a faint odor that it was always on his clothing. And, you know, that was sort of the end of it, that I, as far as I was aware. But the day before his funeral, he let me know that he had to leave, that there were other things that he needed to do. So that was very interesting to me. Healing, it made me feel happy. I was extraordinarily distressed over his death. I knew it was coming one of these days when I began my work with him. He said to me, "You know, I could drop dead any day." You know, he had heart problems.
Right.
We became very good friends and did a lot of good work together. And I was just pleased. Another time, I was asked to be hypnotized. And I was in my bedroom with the hypnotist, and I wanted to recall in more detail things that I was going to put into my book. And one of them was Stanton. And so she, I talked about Stanton, and she said, "Well, tell me what he's wearing." And so I described what I was seeing in my mind's eye. And then, after I was brought out of hypnosis, she said, "I saw Stanton standing in the corner of your room. I could see him from the top of his head to just below the waist, and he was a little tilted forward. I wish that she had told me to open my eyes, because I was describing what he was wearing."
My word. Now, and he said he had to move on. He had something else to do. You know, Annie is very different. She is very proactively engaged in working with people to help them take their, intensify their spiritual journey. The last time I had contact with her was about a month and a half ago, and I got a channeled diary from her, which I get every two or three years. And it was about her being available as a teacher. So they have many different purposes and directions on the other side. It's very clear. And some of them don't ever, you never hear a word from them. Others you hear a lot from. And I'm so glad that you got that from Stanton, because I know it must have been very hard the way he went. And you were, you know, you were engaged in an ongoing work life together in a deep, profound friendship. And then suddenly, bang, it's over. Mm-hmm. So we're just about coming to the end of the time we have together, Kathleen. And I would like to thank you again for the time you have spent with us. Awakening soul, awakening. Can you give us the Awakening Souls website again?
The-awakening-souls.com.
Soul or souls?
Souls, plural.
Plural. Mm-hmm. And they can reach it also through your website?
Yes, I do believe I have a link on my website as well.
Good. Which is Kathleen-Marden.com. Very well worth exploring. And if you have never read a book by Kathleen Marden, or Kathleen Marden and Stanton Friedman, or Kathleen Marden and Denise Stoner, I suggest that you go to her website and pick a few up. They are all, I've never read one that I could put down. Let me put it that way. Extraterrestrial Contact is a stunner. Captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience, as you heard before. You talk about it from the horse's mouth. I mean, she was there in the house when they made the first phone call to tell her mother what had happened. The alien abduction files, amazing. It's all just, what a life and what a story, Kathleen Marden. I can hardly wait until you come back. So don't follow Stanton anytime soon, please.
Well, I don't want to. I have too much work to do here.
Me too. I'm busy. Thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
It was such a pleasure, Whitley, as always.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family.